You may remember Coleman Domingo as a variety of memorable characters in Passing Strange, both on Broadway and in Spike Lee's film version. In his new one-man show, A Boy and His Soul, Mr. Domingo plays even more characters, all members of his own family, with a soundtrack of soul hits from his childhood in Philadelphia. It's gotten rave reviews, and it's run at the Vineyard Theater at 108 East 15th Street between Park Avenue South and Irving Place. It's just been extended to November 1st. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Domingo to our show, which is being broadcast live from the Jerome L. Green space here in on Varick Street on the corner of Charlton, right? And since this is one of the two most important venues in the neighborhood, the other being the Film Forum on Houston,
yeah.
I want to rename this neighborhood the Charlton-Houston neighborhood.
I think you should.
Passing Strange was an autobiographical show starring Stu, and you played a number of supporting roles. Did that inspire you to tell your own story, or had you already planned to do something like this?
I already started writing the play back in 2004, and I did a production of it in San Francisco in 2005. And so basically the seeds were already started, and the foundation had already begun. And then I took basically 2.5 years off to do Passing Strange. And then once Passing Strange was done, it was time to get back to my own work.
A recent profile of you in the New York Times mentions that your mother and stepfather both passed away just before you began to work on Passing Strange.
Yeah.
So this show probably feels like a bit of an homage to them on some level.
It does. It feels like a tribute to them and a tribute to a time in all of our lives and an era and a place that is now in my memories, you know, truly. But it's a place that, you know, we can always go deep into our memories and find all the things that we need to keep on moving forward. And so I think that's the essence of the play itself, you know?
Well, it sure is about memory because it opens as you're going through a collection of old LPs. We're talking vinyl.
Yeah.
in the basement of your childhood home just before it's to be sold. Was that something that really happened?
That was something that actually did happen. My mother asked me to go and clean out the house because they were living in Virginia and they were having some health issues. And so I needed to go down there and take care of my parents' house. And they left a whole tomb of my childhood memories basically down in that basement, especially, you know, lots of records and old bicycles and things like that. And I just sat down there and it was just a flood and a rush of memories that came over me, and I was inspired to write about these things.
In West Philadelphia?
Yeah, West Philly.
That neighborhood went into a decline while you were living there?
Oh, absolutely. It was a place where I grew up, you know. I think in the play I even say, my mother always says, remember where you come from and remember, you know. But in my memories and what I knew about where I grew up, I was a very working class, you know, people who believed in education and, you know, moving their children along. And when I go back to the neighborhood now, it's fallen into a decline, I think, especially after the Reagan years. And the neighborhood is just, you know, lots of drug dealers and thugs and things like that.
But even then, there was a certain transition.
Yeah.
People called you a nerd when you were a kid because you played a violin.
Oh, yeah, I played violin. I did everything that you weren't supposed to do in West Philly. Yeah.
Did you?
I listened to classical music. I was such a nerd. I was always in the library. And, you know, but now it's kind of cool that nerds are in now. Nerds are hip and cool. It's cool to be a nerd.
Well,
so, yeah, so.
Ever since Barack Obama became president,
exactly.
A former nerd.
Yeah, exactly.
Did people suspect even then that you might wind up being gay?
I think people suspected. I think my mother said, you know, when I came out to my mom, that she said, you know, a mother always knows. You know, a mother, you know, she always knows. You know, whether you deal with it or not, you always know, and then you're just waiting for the opportunity for it to come to light.
Your title, A Boy and His Soul, is a play on words, evoking the personal and musical meanings of the word soul. Was that your title from the start?
Yeah, that definitely was. I knew it was an exploration of soul music and the music that laid the foundation for my growth and in my family's transitions, and also about going deeper into your soul. And it was an exploration that I was, I guess, actually doing at that moment. Yeah.
Well, when I was a kid, I found rock and roll, and mm-hmm. my parents, of course, considered that an abomination. But in this situation, your family was very much into this music.
Oh, yeah.
And you didn't rebel. Well, you did for a while.
For a minute, I did. You know, I was always known as that. You know, they were just looking at me like, why are you so weird? Why are you so strange? Why do you want to play violin and then, you know, or a cello or you name it. It was like, I was just interested in those things.
And then you admit to having liked the Carpenters.
Oh, yeah. I love the Carpenters. I still love the Carpenters. Yeah. Who doesn't, right?
In the show, you portray all your family members, mother, father, sister, brother, aunt, cousin, and others, and you have a kind of physical shorthand for each of them.
Yeah.
How did you go about distilling each of them down to one easily recognizable image without reducing them to caricatures?
And that was the tough thing, I think. I think I just wanted to make sure that I didn't want to deal with, you know, I didn't want it to be about costume changes or anything like that, because I think all of these characters live inside of me. So I just wanted to give them one clean, clear gesture. Like my sister has a, because she has she used to smoke when she was a teenager, and it was just an image that I was always very aware of, that she always had a cigarette in her hand.
But it's also the way she stands.
Oh, yeah.
She has a cigarette. She's
got a cigarette, you know, stands, you know, she stands, she's very, you know, has a little attitude, a little, you know, a little ghetto queen madness going on. she embraces that term.
You describe an Earth, Wind, and Fire concert she took you to as a major event in your childhood.
Huge. Yeah. The Earth, Wind, and Fire concert, 1978, at the Mound Music Center in Fairmount Park, was an enormous event because I'd never seen anything like it. I think the smells, the people, the lights, the energy of it all. And I think it just really did. I believe that it really, you know, our first concert experiences, I really feel like, shakes us to our core and challenges who we are and opens us up to everything we want to be.
So then you started listening to that music.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But I never gave up my violin.
You still play it?
You know, I don't anymore. When I got to high school, I went to the scholars program, and music sort of took a back seat because that was just part of what my parents wanted for me to go to college and, you know, excel.
But did you always know you'd be a performer?
No, not at all. I didn't think I would be a performer at all growing up. I was very shy. I had a lisp. All those things that it keeps you very internal. But I listened a lot and I watched a lot. And then I just took, my mother put me, because I was very shy, my mother put me in this, vacation Bible school where basically they had, some actor training, you know, playing games and, you know, playing, doing make-believe. And I excelled at that.
Well, during the show, you sing rather well,
yeah.
And you dance very well.
Thank you.
Did you have to relearn those steps, or did you know how to dance all of those things in the 70s?
I knew how to dance all of those things, and then it just took a great choreographer. I've worked with a choreographer before named Margot Hall in San Francisco, who helped finesse certain things, and then Ken Roberson, who is, you know, tops here in New York City, he helped me finesse many things. Especially, you know, I'm playing things like, can I say this? I'm playing a crack blank stripper. You can fill
in what?
Blank,
yeah,
yeah. I can say things like that here.
Yes.
I'm playing a crack horse stripper at one point. I play, you know, and she has a big old dance number, and so you know, I had to learn things like that because, you know, I'm not a crack horse stripper in my real life.
You've never done a pole dance before. My guest is Coleman Domingo, whose one-man show, A Boy in His Soul, has just been extended to November 1st because of audience response and the rave reviews. It's at the Vineyard Theater at 108 East 15th Street between Park Avenue South and Irving Place. We get the sense that Edie, your mother, was a gentlewoman, and your stepfather, Clarence's, favorite way of sitting is to be sprawled in his chair.
Yes. Yes.
But he seemed to have a good relationship with you, even though he wasn't your birth father.
Absolutely. I think, first of all, I applaud any man who comes along in a family, you know, to a woman with three kids and fathers them and loves them as if they were his own. And that's what he did for me.
He was a man with strong opinions, mostly about music.
Absolutely. He had strong opinions about everything, especially about music. Whatever the sounds that was going on in the house, he had a very strong opinion.
Well, how did he relate to you? Because you were...
They didn't know how to deal with it.
You were a little effeminate.
Yeah, I was a little effeminate. I was very strange. I was, and you know, my father was this blue collar, big strong man. You know, manly man. And he knew how to relate to my younger brother, who was, you know, the sort of type A, you know, heterosexual male. And then there's me, this little sissy, basically.
Well, they were afraid that you'd be like your cousin Seiferdine.
Yeah, Seiferdine. And
where does that name come from? I never heard.
You
the
know
name
what,
Seiferdine.
Seiferdine was a. One was my cousin that was always shrouded in mystery. He showed up at funerals and veils and gowns and things. And I was always very intrigued at what Seiferdine was. I didn't even know what Seiferdine was. Now, Seiferdine, his real name is Jeffrey, but he called himself Cypher Dean. But when I saw him at my first gay club, his name was Miss Roxy. Mm-hmm. Still shrouded in mystery.
Well, you talk about coming out to your brother when he brought you to a strip club for a lap dance on your 21st birthday. How did he react?
How did he react? Mm-hmm. Well, he was he reacted in a way that I think that is very is not too common, I think, and which is why I wanted to tell that story. That my big, strong, heterosexual male brother embraced me with love and understanding.
And the whole family wound up. Your sister wasn't upset that you were gay, but that you hadn't told her first.
Exactly.
There's a theater reviewer in the Bay Area wrote that she didn't believe a black family would accept a gay son.
Exactly. And that was something that I was really upset about. This one critic said that, from what I know, watching Marlon Riggs documentaries and such, it's very hard to come out in the black community. And I said, well... from watching documentaries. And I said, well, from my experience, I think this is my experience, which is valid, and I want to add another story, you know, to the American theater.
But there's often mixed messages in the black community. I've been to a number of churches over the years because of my interest in gospel music. And you mentioned that the church choir members were all gay. And I would be sitting in a church where the choir was gay and maybe some of the performers were gay. And then the minister would preach against sissies and bulldaggers.
Yes, exactly.
And nobody seemed to think that there was anything strange about that.
Well, and that's the hypocrisy about, I think, with a lot of our churches as well. It's like, you know, and I think that's the thing that keeps us from truly becoming together as a community, because I think there's all this, you know, hypocrisy, truly, you know, and, you know, of course, I think it's very well known. You go to any choir. Who's yelling and screaming the most? The big black queens, you know, right? Right.
And the biggest stars, people like James Cleveland when you were a kid, he was gay.
Yes.
So there is a kind of an irony there. Yeah. There's a lot of music in the show. How did you choose which songs to include? Were you limiting yourself mostly to Philadelphia?
No. I, at first,
because you do have Aretha from Detroit.
Yeah. No, I included everyone. I think I just wanted to... just be very assured of the foundation of the music that I listened to and in my house, which was a lot of the Spinners, and you know there was a lot of Philadelphia International groups and stuff that I just listened to all the time. It was just really truly the Philly sound, but also there were sounds and the music sort of just, I don't know whether the music chose the piece or the piece chose the music, but they were inspired by both. You know, sometimes the stories.
You've worked as a director on other people's shows, but for this one, Tony Kelly directed. Yeah. Would it have been impossible or unwise to direct it yourself?
I think so. I think I'm just a true collaborator. I think the actors need directors. I think I need someone else to, you know, call the shots, and I need someone else to actually be, you know, but also someone to work with, you know, in tandem and really just work with the designers and really help your vision get to the greatest light. And also there are things that I can't see, you know, because I'm so deep in it. This is such a personal story. And it's good to, you know, to have a director on the outside to say, hey, an audience needs this to get into that story. And that's what's very smart about that, about having collaborators.
The film version of Passing Strange was directed by Spike Lee, and some reviewers felt it was better than the stage version. Yeah. I'm not going to ask you what you think, but what was it like working with him?
Oh, Spike Lee is a fantastic, fantastic, wonderful, generous man. He actually came to the show on Friday night, and he and his wife spent their 16th anniversary with me, and that was beautiful. They, you know, they came and saw the show, and he's just very supportive, and he's extremely generous, you know, and very. He just basically tells you to, you know, he supports you to do what he knows that you can do.
Now, the show is very funny, even though it's a poignant story. Mm-hmm. Was that something that just grew out of the experiences?
I guess it has, and I guess my own personal experience is the way that you move through tragedy, and I had, like we were talking about 2006 when I lost both of my parents, was just enormous tragedy, and the only way to keep moving through these things is with some laughter through the tears. And so I think that's just my sensibility as well, that you can't have one without the other.
So the show has been extended to November 1st, and then what?
And then, I don't know, hopefully, you know, it keeps moving. Maybe we'll go to Broadway. Who knows? I'll just put that out there. Why not? Because I think it's a story that I would love for it to be, you know, recognized commercially and for it be seen by wide audiences. And so whatever that means, or whether that means I'm just doing it in my basement and I sell tickets there and people come and see it, that's fine too.
Well, despite the fact that it's very specific about your experience, there's also a universality to the story.
Yeah, and I think, and hopefully that's because I've, I've, I've strived to become even more specific about the experience of growing up in West Philadelphia with these people, these folks with these very specific cadence of speech, the way they move, the way they live and love each other.
Your father was from Central America?
Yeah, my father was from Belize. He's still there.
That had to have been weird. I mean, in
West Philly, it was weird because, my dad, he would come around and he had a very strange accent and there was lots of questions about that. And he drove a big yellow Impala and, it was a little odd. Yeah, of course. Absolutely.
Is he back in Belize?
My dad is in L.A. at the moment, actually. He gets around.
And
Papa was a Rolling Stone.
Coleman Domingo is here, but you can see him at the Vineyard Theater at 108 East 15th Street until November 1st, performing in his one-man show called A Boy and His Soul. And congratulations on the great reviews.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate it.